Rude to me. I was having a bad day. My ma and I had a fight that morning. It was so stupid. Our fights are always stupid. That day, I think she was mad at me for leaving only two eggs. She said, "You couldn't really get a good scramble from two eggs." And I said, "I'll make you two fried." And she said she didn't want fried or poached. She wanted scrambled. And two didn't fluff up enough. Next thing you know, we were screaming our heads off at each other. That's how we fought, like cats and dogs, like Andy Cap and Flo. We screamed at each other. And she said I couldn't have the car to get to work that day. I'd have to walk in the rain. Trudging to work, I knew she would feel bad when I got home. She would apologize, bring me a towel for my hair, dry my shoes so they wouldn't end up stiff and out of shape from the long walk. She would make me tea, and we would eat our dinner on trays together. We fought a lot, but we always made up. But until we make up, I always feel out of sorts, as if the world isn't quite right. That's why I yelled at the girl, told her to get out of the store. She must have come back later. Maybe she broke in, up to some mischief, and someone followed her. That's what I think happened, and that's all I told the lady who wrote me. Okay, I told her about the army, too, the things they did to me there. Like I said, I'm not as smart as my ma. That lady used me. A pretty lady put her picture inside a letter, said we had something in common, that I was the last person to see Tessie Fine alive, and she was the first person to see her dead, and that bonded us. I wasn't so dumb that I fell for that. I wrote, "No, the last person to see Tessie Fine alive was the person who killed her, and that wasn't me." But I still said too much, and none of it privileged, as my lawyer and ma kept yelling at me when it came out. But then the lawyer calmed down and said, "Maybe it's a gift, after all. Maybe I can use this." Ma was mad at first. She said, "No one's going to say my Stephen is crazy." But the lawyer changed Ma's mind pretty fast. May 1966. Maddie dressed carefully for her visit to the Star. Her instincts told her that this was an occasion to present as her old self, gloves and a hat, even though the weather was finally warm. How odd she looked this way. How unlike the person she knew she was now. But her shorter skirts and dresses, the bright colors she had taken to wearing, these would not make her look serious. She had to convey seriousness, a sense of purpose. It was an easy thing to walk down the hill to the newspaper building, not even a mile from where she lived. How simple it would be if she got a job to make that walk Monday through Friday. How satisfying to return home up the hill, tired after a long day. She wondered if people at the newspaper socialized, if she would be invited out. She also wondered how Ferdy would feel if she were no longer at his beck and call. Would he care? Or would he be relieved? It could create the pretext for a graceful ending, assuming that was what he wanted. But just crossing the threshold into the building undermined her confidence. She had to approach a huge desk where a woman sat at a phone bank, elevated, like a judge. "Who are you here to see?" she demanded. "Mr. Bauer," Maddie said, hating the way her voice scaled up, as if she had no right to be in this holy place, asking for the well-known man who had sat in her apartment and pleaded to tell her story. "Is he expecting you?"
"No."
"What's your name?" She provided it in a whisper, almost as if she were afraid to be overheard, then waited at the switchboard operator's instruction on a wooden bench. After much muttering and sighing, the woman said, "Fifth floor." "What?"
Fifth floor. He's in the Sunday office on the fifth floor."
Maddie's first impression of the newsroom was that it was, well, filthy. Filthy and loud. So many newspapers piled everywhere. People shouting,
typewriters clacking, a bell ringing somewhere. And so many men. But there were women working here, she reminded herself. She had read their bylines, seen their stories. Women could be reporters, too. Mr. Bauer had a desk in the corner of the room where the Sunday staff worked. Its windows faced south, toward the water, and the view would have been bright and expansive if the windows had not been caked with dust and dirt. Someone had written in the grime, "The Star, one of the world's newspapers." It took Maddie a moment to get the joke. The Beacon, the more sober morning newspaper, with foreign bureaus and a large staff in Washington, called itself one of the world's best newspapers.
"I'm surprised to see you here," he said,
leaning back in his chair. He seemed different at first, and Maddie realized the man she had met had been playing a part of sorts, pretending interest in her, pretending empathy, pretending whatever he needed to pretend to get what he wanted. Now he didn't need anything from her, or so he thought. "I want a job here." He smiled.
"I'm not the editor, Ms. Schwartz. I don't do the hiring. If I did, I'm not sure I'd stump for a woman with no experience."
"But you can help me."
"Maybe. Only, why would I? This is a serious place for serious people. You just don't walk in off the street and start doing it."
"I helped you get..." She debated with herself whether to use the word, whether it would make her sound ridiculous. "I helped you get a scoop." Another smile. Yet, it didn't cow her. She did not feel ridiculous. She knew what she had in her purse.
"You deflected me. You were lucky that the deflection worked.
I offered you something better than what you were seeking. I wouldn't call that deflection."
"And now you think you want to work at the newspaper? What could you possibly bring to this job?"
She pulled out a sheaf of papers tied with string. "These are letters from Stephen Corwin. I wrote him about the murder of Tessie Fine, and he wrote me back. Twice." The room did not go quiet. It was a place that was never quiet, Maddie sensed. But something shifted. Other people were listening to them now, or trying to. Perhaps Mr. Bauer noticed as well, because he said,
"Take a walk with me."
She assumed he meant outside, but he took her to the corridor, then down a back staircase.
"May I see them?"
"I'll show you the first one," she said. Mr. Bauer could read very quickly.
"So what?" he said. "He doesn't admit anything. He just repeats this cockamamie story that the girl came back and he was gone. No one believes it."
"I don't either," Maddie says. "But there's a detail that suggests he has an accomplice." He raised his eyebrows.
"I've heard of reading between the lines, but you've all but moved in between them and built a house. That's a lot to infer. So he made up a story about someone else doing it. How do you get accomplice from that?"
"Not from there," Maddie said. "Go back to the earlier part of the letter about how he fought with his mother that day."
"That drivel with the eggs, not even I could make it interesting."
"No, the part about how he walked to work."
"Right, so?"
"Tessie Fine's body was found almost 2 miles from the pet shop." "How did it get there? Whose car did he use?" I went back and read all the articles about him at the Enoch Pratt. How purposeful she had felt, going to the central branch, just steps from her front door and requesting the long wooden rods of the daily newspapers. She had seldom used the Pratt. It felt castle-like compared to the modern blandness that was the Randallstown branch where she had checked out popular novels.
"He probably hid the body overnight, took it out the next day."
"Maybe. Or maybe he realized that he slipped, telling that part, which suggests there's an accomplice or someone with knowledge of what he's done. That's why he wrote me the second letter about his time at Fort Detrick."
"What about it?"
"Stephen Corwin was drafted 5 years ago. He claimed conscientious objector status as a Seventh-day Adventist. He was sent to Fort Detrick and was part of an experiment known as Operation Whitecoat.
That's ridiculous, Mr. Bauer said. The Army doesn't run tests that turn men into killers of little girls.
It sounds ridiculous to me, too, Maddie said, as if he's grasping at straws. But it's interesting, isn't it? Something that hasn't been published yet.
I'd like to write the account of our correspondence. Won't that expose you to all the things you feared when I first visited you? Revelations about your personal life? Embarrassment to your son?
Not if it's under my name. If I'm the author. He needed a few seconds to process what she was requesting.
Byline, he said. You want a byline? You want us to hire you, and then your first piece will be this page one scoop. But that's not how it works, Lois Lane. What are you going to do, insert yourself into every big murder? Dress up like a wino and go out and find the tic-tac-toe killer who's terrorizing Baltimore's drunks? Maybe come up with something on the JFK assassination before the Warren Commission reports its findings? That's not reporting. That makes you more like a stunt woman. Some second-rate Nellie Bly.
Another mask had slipped. She had offended him. And Maddie, whose instincts for what men need were unerring, knew immediately how to make it right. Would it be so wrong if I wrote this? With your help? And that would be my tryout? I'm happy to start at the bottom, to work my way up. I'm not asking for special treatment.
Oh, Maddie, newspaper work coarsens women. You should see the battle axe who covers labor.
I'd like to think that whatever I do, I'll always be a woman first.
I bet you will, he said. Look, this would be easier if I could have the letters, show them to my bosses.
She slipped the one back into her purse. I don't actually have the second one with me. I came here first. I came to you first. But there are two other newspapers in town, the Beacon and the Light. Maybe I should visit them, see what they offer. 2 days later, 2 days of sitting by Mr. Bauer's side, sometimes typing, sometimes talking, letting him rewrite her, but also insisting at certain moments on having her way with the words that were forming on the copy paper in his cantankerous typewriter. Maddie's piece appeared on the front page. A killer unburdens himself. Mr. Bauer had the byline, but her name appeared in italicized print, based on a correspondence with Madeline Schwartz, part of the search party that discovered Tessie Fine's body. Her correspondence was woven into a larger story, augmented by Mr. Bauer's reporting. An Army spokesman said staunchly that the treatments Stephen Corwin had been subjected to would not, could not, induce psychosis. His mother said Stephen was an unhappy person and had always been a disappointment to her, that everything he said was a lie, even the story about the eggs. He had shifty friends, men of whom she did not approve. Finally, his attorney tried to subpoena Maddie, only to be told that her notes were protected by Maryland's Shield Law because she was a contractual employee at the Star. And if the newspaper's lawyer implied that contract predated her correspondence with Corwin, as opposed to being drawn up hastily in the wake of the request, he never said as much in so many words. And the inexperienced public defender gave up that line of attack, deciding to focus on the idea that Corwin wasn't competent to stand trial. The story was a sensation, dominating the news for several days. In part, Maddie was the story. Attractive, not quite divorcee, tricks kid killer into revealing he had an accomplice. But she never lost sight of the fact that she had made the story and, with Mr. Bauer's help, written the story. After all, although she had the good sense not to mention it to Mr. Bauer or anyone else at the Star, she had once yearned to write poetry and fiction, had worked at the high school newspaper, which was where she had met Alan Durst. which had indirectly almost destroyed her life. Now, perhaps, writing would indirectly help her reinvent her life. Maddie's reward for her scoop was a job as an assistant to the man who ran the Star's helpline column, Don Heath, who was highly skeptical. "I've never had an assistant. Why do they think I need an assistant all of a sudden?" Mr. Heath fretted. "I guess you can open the mail. When you get the hang of things, I'll let you tackle some of the easier questions, the ones we don't write up for the paper." Given the mundane inquiries that did make it into the paper, Maddie wondered just how fatuous the others could be. But it didn't matter. She had a desk. She had a job. As she sliced open the envelopes that arrived daily, a Sisyphean array of petty complaints, she imagined a future self explaining to someone young, someone worshipful, how it all began. Maybe to Seth, maybe a room full of college girls. They say a journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. Well, my journey of not even 50 steps, from the helpline desk to the real newsroom, began with 1,000 paper cuts. At night, Ferdy rubbed cream into her hands and worried over the damage she was doing to her lovely nails. Maddie told him, with a confidence that felt different from her old confidence, "I won't be opening the mail forever." Mr. Helpline. "I never asked for an assistant. And it scares me when they suddenly announce I need one. They put me in the helpline job 4 years ago when I started making, let's call them, mistakes. Nothing fatal or libelous. I got confused one day, said that a local banker who was getting an award had gone to Crown University in Long Island. No, I had never heard of such a place, but that's what it sounded like to me. Damn young people mutter and mumble so much these days. Okay, so it was Brown University in Rhode Island. They caught it before it went into the paper. Isn't that what the copy desk is for, to spot that kind of error? They sent me to an audiologist, but my hearing checked out fine. I told them that I had a couple of drinks at lunch that day. It's not like other reporters didn't do it. We're an evening paper. Final Street deadline was 2 p.m. You filed, allowed the editor his tinkers, fought the good fight, then went to lunch. I like Connolly's, practically across the street, decent fish sandwich. Came back, did the interview. It could happen to anyone. I promised I wouldn't drink anymore. I didn't tell them that I hadn't had a drink that day. They bought it. But they eased me out of the column. Gave it to that snake in the grass, Bauer. Oh, such a nice man with his nice stories about his nice family. I'd rather gouge my eyes out than write that sentimental crap. They gave me the helpline column and a good editor. And from time to time took surreptitious, or so they thought, sniffs at my breath. If only there were something there to smell. I'd rather have gin or vodka on my lips. But I guess when the brain starts to go, it doesn't rot in a way that creates an odor. My doctor says there's no sign of dementia. He forgets. Ha ha. The doctor I asked to diagnose my dementia, he forgets things. That I've been there. I've seen it, close up. It took my mom, and don't tell me these things don't run in families. She started just the way I did, a mental slip here, a mental slip there. My doctor says forgetting things isn't the real issue. He asks me if I recognize the people in my life, if I ever forget basic words, so far so good. But if that's the case, why did they give me an assistant? Train her, they said. She's eager, not young, but eager. They can't fool me. She's almost 40. Who starts working at a newspaper at that age? I wonder if she's a nurse or someone hired to spy on me. It's not paranoia if they're really out to get you. The union makes it hard for them to fire me, but the union can't protect me if I make a big mistake, if I'm really sick. You can drink yourself to death in a corner of the newsroom. Ned Brown is doing it as we speak. That's okay. But if I show up here without my pants on one day, I'm out. Luckily, it's hard to make a big mistake. Running helpline. A monkey could do it as long as he wasn't getting senile. The assistant's first week, I can't figure out what to do with her. I'm in a corner of the office, the better to be forgotten. They managed to carve out a little spot for her, which irritates me. I'm used to my privacy, to speaking on the phone without being overheard. I send her to fetch coffee, which takes up, maybe 10 minutes total every day. Finally, I turn the mail over to her, tell her to screen it. I say, that will give me that much more time to work on my immortal prose. She laughs. She's the kind of woman who laughs at men's jokes even when they're not funny. The real joke is, I have the stupidest column in the paper, but it's also the most popular. You can't believe the mail it generates, and yeah, I confess, I wasn't getting to all of it. I read until I had enough problems to fill the space. 4 columns a week. I need at least 12 good questions, and they have to be consumer complaints, things I can do something about. I'm not Dear Abby, but you wouldn't know it by my mail. I don't think anyone lives long enough to imagine his next decade accurately. You get to 30, and you think you know what 40 will be like, but you don't. Then comes 50, and boy, does 40 look good. I'm 58 right now, and I'm not going to pretend I have a clue what my 7th decade will be other than disappointing. Because every decade so far has been less than I hoped. Why should the next one be different? I'll confess this, too. I have a system for culling my mail. Typewritten over handwritten, masculine handwriting over feminine handwriting, cursive only, no jailbirds, I don't care if they have photographic evidence of the cops framing them. I'm here to fix traffic lights and find out why you can't return a pair of shearling gloves to Hutzler's if the tags are still attached. The store agreed finally to take them back for store credit. I guess Hutzler's thought the gloves were shoplifted, and yeah, they probably were. Mr. Helpline isn't here to make moral judgments. So, I give the eager beaver the mail. She does a good job, maybe too good. She catches on quickly, this one. She gets what makes a good question, learns to recognize the duds. She works the phones before she shows me the letters, making sure there are answers. She creates a whole new category. Easy problems that don't rate a column mention, but can be addressed by a quick phone call. I don't like that at first, but then I decide why not. I still follow up, I still write the column, it's my style that makes it popular. My style. And the fact that it's one of two things in the papers that's actually trying to help people. The other is obits. You won't catch me saying this around the newsroom. But people are right that newspapers prefer bad news to good most of the time. Bad news sells papers. There is no Happy Valley Gazette. Ambition comes off this one like heat. Where did you come from? I want to ask. Didn't you have a husband, pretty as you are? Is Bob Bauer trying to get into your panties? You wouldn't be the first. The way I hear it. Mr. Family Man, professional nice guy. There are no nice guys in this business. But you'll learn that soon enough. I make her start bringing me my lunch. June 1966. Okay, Scoop, we're gonna let you try out your training wheels. Calvin Weeks, the assistant city editor, loomed over Maddie, an ominous piece of copy paper in his hands. Only 2 weeks into her job, Maddie already knew the legend of Calvin Weeks and his black beans, which he usually shoved into reporters' mail cubbyholes at the end of his shift. He typed these missives on carbon paper, keeping the originals for himself and bestowing the smudgy duplicates on the reporters. Perhaps those smudges were why they were called black beans, but no one really knew. Calvin Weeks had been an assistant city editor for almost 20 years, and he had been dispensing black beans for 19 of them.
"There's a reason he's been in that job for so long," Bob Bauer had told Maddie. "You've heard of the Peter Principle. This is the Cal Corollary. The newspaper's version of the Hippocratic Oath. First, do the least harm. That's why he's on the 3-to-11 shift. If a big story happens late, the overnight editor takes over. If news breaks during the day, the big bosses are here. Weeks is a traffic cop at best, directing the flow of copy."
It was 3:30 p.m. Maddie's workday ended in 90 minutes. That should have been all the excuse she needed not to slip her neck into the noose that Cal was holding. "I'm off at 5.
"I'm sure Don won't mind if I borrow you."
Mr. Heath nodded, a master surrendering his servant. Did he have the power to do that? Who was her true boss? Maddie should probably figure that out.
"There's a little party this afternoon," Cal continued. "Normally we just send a photog, but with all the Negroes being so upset these days, the big boss thought it was a good opportunity to generate a little goodwill, show that we don't only write about the riots and muggings."
He handed her the piece of paper, the black bean, reciting its contents as she scanned it.
"Violet Wilson White is celebrating her 29th year on the police force today. Isn't that something? The first Negro cop was a woman. So, there's a little party for her at headquarters. You go by, get a few quotes, how she got started, how honored she is, rutabaga, rutabaga, and file 6 inches. We'll use it inside tomorrow."
Rutabaga, rutabaga was another Cal tick. His version of et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Again, no one had a clue how this had come to be. He reminded Maddie of an actor she had seen in The King and I at Painter's Mill, a mediocre one who was nevertheless extraordinarily pleased with himself as he strutted the stage in that dusty tent theater. He had entered for one scene by marching up the aisle alongside Maddie's seat, his cape flying behind him, although Maddie did not believe capes were worn by Siamese royalty. The cape's hem, flowing behind him on eddies of summer heat, had whipped the corner of her eye. It hadn't hurt, but the unexpected contact was startling, and Maddie gave a little yelp. The actor had looked back, smiling as if he had bestowed a gift, then continued steaming toward the stage, where he proceeded to destroy Oscar Hammerstein's lyrics with a performance that appeared to be modeled on Marlon Brando in A Streetcar Named Desire. She tried again. "I'm off at 5.
"Then you better get going."
She understood, or was pretty sure that she did. The press release had come in late, but some higher up was demanding it be done, and Cal was carrying the bigger boss's water. The year was shaping up to be one of unrest throughout the United States, riots breaking out in various cities. Baltimore had been spared so far. Maddie was being given this big chance because Cal assumed she was too timid to file for overtime. Or she was hungry enough for a byline to forego her right to extra pay. He was right on both counts. She walked up to Police HQ, showed her star ID.
"That's not a press pass," she was told.
"I know," she said. She didn't. "But I work there. They sent me here because Mr. Diller is busy." Yet Diller, the police reporter, was in the room. Why couldn't he write the story? But Maddie, again courtesy of Bob Bauer, knew why. Diller couldn't write anything. He called in his facts, then the rewrite man shaped them into a publishable article. It was a beginner's job, and most men angled to leave the police beat as soon as possible, eager to write the words that appeared beneath their bylines. Diller had no desire to move on. Diller could dictate the facts about a Negro woman if she were dead. He could do that in his sleep. But faced with a story without a crime, he wouldn't have a clue where to begin. Maddie took out her thrillingly fresh reporter's notebook and tried to keep up with the police commissioner's rote, banal compliments. She had never learned shorthand, and she wasn't sure how one was supposed to get quotes exactly right without it, but she did the best she could on the fly, creating her own set of abbreviations. The room was crowded, but the cake, not Violet Wilson White, seemed to be the star attraction. When the commissioner insisted the guest of honor say a few words, she kept her comments short and spoke softly, but with a notable confidence and authority.
"Thank you," she said. "I'm just glad to be here, 29 years later, but my work is not done, not yet."
She leaned hard on that last word.
"Here's to 29 years more,"
someone shouted from the back of the room. Inane, Maddie thought, rude even. It sounded sarcastic, as if the man who had spoken was mocking Mrs. White. She wondered if Ferdy was here. Certainly other Negro officers should have been called downtown for this particular celebration. But the crowd was very sparse and very white. She asked Diller as much, not about Ferdy, but the lack of Negroes in general.
"It's a dog and pony show for the press," he said. "Who gets a party for her 29th year? They threw it together at the last minute. Straight up public relations ploy to remind everyone that they do more with Negroes than bust their heads open."
"Then why are we covering it?" He gave her an odd look.
"Wait. Are you with the Star?"
"I am. I'm Maddie." But he had already moved away, having secured his slice of cake, a brick of a corner piece. He was with a group of men. Reporters, like him probably. What did one call a group of reporters? A gaggle would be good, Maddie thought. A murder of crows, a gaggle of reporters. She approached the guest of honor, notebook out, and introduced herself as a reporter. She was doing a reporter's job, was she not? Mrs. White demurred.
"I've had many opportunities to talk about myself. If you checked the files before you came here, and of course I'm sure you did, you must know everything about me."
A veiled rebuke, and a fair one. Maddie should have pulled the clips from the library. Her face flamed. But she was not going to go back to the newsroom without a story. She was being tested, and Maddie had always aced her tests.
"What's it like, being a first?"
"Not that different from being the second or the third or the thousandth."
"But the department still doesn't have that many Negroes, and they're not allowed to do as much as their white counterparts." Ferdy had told her that, of course. Negroes could be patrols or vice cops, and that was pretty much it. No cars, no radios. Maddie had chosen not to ask Ferdy how he wrangled a patrol car for his late-night visits to her. Mrs. White, clearly surprised by Maddie's knowledge, softened a little.
"Well, I'm an old hand at making more out of less. I walked a beat on Pennsylvania Avenue when I was younger. I felt like I did more for the children of that neighborhood in that job than I did as a teacher. I'm not criticizing teachers. I was one, and my husband has spent his entire career in the school system, but there were plenty of women teaching. The children saw them every day. When I walked down the street in my uniform, I showed them that there were other things to be. We cannot imagine what we cannot see."
Maddie scribbled furiously. She was so taken by Mrs. White's fierce pride in her job that she almost forgot the basic questions, her age, her husband's name. She then asked a little about where she had grown up, how her parents had felt about their daughter's vocation, what she did to relax at day's end. The last question amused Mrs. White.
Watch a little television, she said. Read the newspaper.
I tried knitting, but all I could make were scarves, and even then the shapes were all over the place. My sister said I was loose with my needles. Maddie was back at the paper by 4:30. She was a fast typist, but not a fast writer, and she labored over her copy. But she was enjoying herself. It was like working on her column back in high school, coming up with witticisms, bestowing nicknames on the other popular kids. It was almost 8 by the time she turned in the requested 400 words. She was too shy to call out, "Copy," as the other reporters did, so she walked the pages to Cal herself.
"Too long," he said,
without even reading the copy, and promptly crossed out the final paragraph with a red X. "But that's the best part," Maddie said. "That was her quote about how she hoped she inspired the children she saw every day. We cannot imagine what we cannot see."
"You're not supposed to put the best stuff at the end."
Since starting at the Star, Maddie had been reading the newspaper with an attention and focus that her previous self had never mustered. She had noticed what made some stories sing, while others were dragnet style. "All we want are the facts, ma'am." "It's a feature, right? Features can have..." She paused, unsure of the word and her right to use it. "Features can have kickers, can't they?"
"It's supposed to be 6 inches about a Negro who's not rioting or stealing."
"But she's interesting," Maddie said. "I think there's more there. We've written about her plenty."
"Be glad that there's even a story. We could have done this with a photo and a cut line, but if you're good, maybe I'll throw some more stories your way."
If you're good. Maddie was not fooled. Cal was going to try to use her for future late afternoon assignments, counting on her ambition and decorum to accept them, counting on her to be too meek to push for what she was owed. "It's past 8, she said. "I've worked 3 hours overtime. How do I enter that on my pay card at week's end?"
"Take comp time," he said airily. "I'll tell Don you can take an hour a day over 3 days."
"Comp time?"
"Compensatory time. It's okay as long as everyone agrees to it. Oh, strictly, it has to be taken that week to keep you below 40 hours, but nobody worries about those technicalities."
Maddie was pretty sure that it was management that didn't worry about such technicalities. "Overtime is paid at 1.5. So shouldn't I get 4.5 hours? Otherwise, comp time sounds like a bad deal to me." His eyes went cold, and what little friendliness he had been able to fake vanished from his face. With his overly sharp incisors, 2 white skin and 2 red eyes, Cal looked like a vampire or an albino cat. He was a man of no true authority, Maddie saw. How it must have grated on him.
"Very well, then," he said. "You've earned 4.5 hours. To be taken by mutual consent. What are you going to do, enjoy a longer lunch hour, go shopping?"
"I'll bank the time for now. One never knows when one might need time. Will you explain the situation to Don, that you asked me to do this for you and I earned comp time?"
"To be taken by mutual consent," Cal said. "You can't just announce that you're leaving early. You'll have to clear it with Don."
"Of course." She walked away, well aware that she had not answered his intrusive questions about what she intended to do with her time. She had no intention of telling him that she planned to find another way to get into the paper. A real story. When the Star was published the next day, her piece had been cut to 5 paragraphs. There was no trace of Maddie's name, and everything she had thought lively or good about the writing, the quotes, had been excised. She didn't care. She cut it out and put it in a manila folder in her desk, which she titled after some thought, Morgan Stern, Madeline. When she did get a byline, maybe that should be the name she used. She opened the letter she had left when Cal had sent her to the police station. Two of them had potential, and she put them to the side to give to Mr. Heath. One was something she could handle. A passerby had noticed that the lights were no longer working at the fountain in Druid Hill Park. She would call the Department of Public Works tomorrow and report the outage. It wasn't worth space in the column. She had learned to make such distinctions by now and was proud of the initiative she showed. Bob Bauer had warned her that Heath was worried that Maddie was gunning for his job. Maddie had her sights set much higher, so high that she could not yet see exactly what she wanted. She cosseted and spoiled Mr. Heath, bringing him Entenmann's cookies or a slice of Sara Lee swirl cake with his afternoon cup of coffee. Soon enough, she was back in his good graces. 4.5 hours, hers to use as she wished. But how did she wish to use them? What could one do with 4.5 hours? An electrician in a rowboat was about to provide the answer. Lady Law. I did not want the party. Who has a party in one's 29th year of employment? I'm not leaving until I make captain, as I have told my superiors numerous times. But I understood what was going on, why the department wanted to celebrate me, why there were photographers, even a reporter, although she seemed very green to me despite her age. I thought she's going to need more confidence to do that job, that's for sure. I have been interviewed quite a bit for much more in-depth pieces. I did not need to be photographed holding a cake knife. Confidence is something I have never lacked. My father taught me not to fear death, and that is why I have been able to do the work that I do. Not fearing death is not the same as being fearless. It means that I am not worried about where I'm headed, the consequences of death. I have not led a blameless life, but I am a Christian woman who prays to my Lord to lead me through my hard times, to forgive me when I slip from the path, to extend a hand and help me back onto the straight and narrow. I often don't like things people think I should like. I don't like parties. I don't like being photographed. I don't like attention. I didn't really like being on that television show to tell the truth, but at least I was the one telling the truth. Still, there was something undignified about it. The whole point of the show is that one is somehow odd, maybe even freakish. I am not freakish. I am a college-educated woman who cared about children. My own, I have four, two that I birthed and two that I adopted, and all the children of the neighborhoods I patrolled. I was in some ways more social worker than police officer. I think, though, I have made more of a difference than social workers. When a social worker comes to a house, she's the enemy, a meddler. When I visited, usually because of reports of drunken or loutish behavior, the mothers welcomed me secretly. They knew I understood that I cared. But I had to put their children first, always. They called me Lady Law. I did like that, especially the first part. I pride myself on my manners, my gentility. In the 1950s, when I supervised several younger women, I stressed the importance of good manners, a civilized appearance. There was no reason that our work had to make us masculine or rough. Sometimes I had to be the strict schoolmarm, if you will. I would catch the young boys sneaking into the movies, cutting school. I'd tell them that I could take them home or to Cheltenham,
It was their choice. They always chose home. I suppose they think that I should be considering retirement. I will be 69 this fall. Perhaps this party was a hint. But I don't take hints. Don't worry about odd looks, muttered criticisms that I may or may not be meant to hear. If someone has something to say to me, he can say it to my face. I am not ready to go. I have not planned my funeral, not even staring into the barrel of a gun as I did with that man who pretended to be a messenger of God, but was just a procurer of young women. Not even that moment prompted me to plan for my funeral. Why would I do it now? I intend to live a good long while. My legacy will be much more than simply being first. That's what I was trying to explain to that reporter, so very tentative for someone well into their 30s. One thing about white people, it's very easy to fix their ages. Their skin tells their age as surely as a tree's rings reveal its age. Ah, well, I was new on this job when I was 40. I suppose it's never too late to start a career. Maybe I'll start a third one when I leave here. I would be a good preacher, I think. But I prefer doing as opposed to exhorting others to do. Maybe there's a business or a charity I can start based on my annual practice of assembling holiday baskets. But I won't use the Lady Law name. That would be undignified. The name will retire with me. The next day, when the afternoon paper comes out, my photo is inside, only a few paragraphs attached, and the girl has misquoted me in spots. But one of the Northwest Patrol officers, Ferdinand Platt, stops me in the hall, asks me questions, rather frivolous ones to my mind. What did I think of the article? Was I pleased with it? I told him the truth, that I was not much interested in articles about myself, that there had been many over the years. Why, my name was appearing in print long before I was a police officer, for my work with Women's Christian Temperance Union chapters nationwide. In my opinion, alcohol is one of the great evils of our age. Drugs, too, of course, but alcohol is legal. When I drive past the Carling plant on the Beltway, I smell more than scorched hops. That is the odor of destroyed, broken families. I have testified before the Kefauver Commission about the danger of narcotics, but alcohol is even worse in terms of the cost it exacts. Yes, I understand the paradox of prohibition. I was an adult woman then. I saw what happened. But I'm not sure making it legal was the solution. That young Ferdinand probably thinks it's a grand thing to be in a newspaper. He is a handsome man, a little too handsome for his own good. According to talk, he also is too cozy with certain men in our community, a particular bad man who tries to hide behind good men. Shell Gordon is a disgrace. He owns the place on Pennsylvania Avenue, the second-rate establishment where the girls are forced to wear those terrible outfits. Ferdy Platt goes there, according to the talk I hear, knows the people who frequent it. A small vice relative to the other sins of this department. Besides, it might even be the mark of a good policeman. The Shell Gordons of the world, criminals, though they may be, have a rooting interest in maintaining order. Mayhem and criminality are their purview, theirs to pursue and organize, and they will not tolerate freelancers. I know the people at the club tried, in the early days of the investigation, to help police figure out what happened to Cleo Sherwood. Her parents are good people. I don't know how the girl turned out the way she did. It's my understanding that she began running wild when she was a teenager. Some girls are simply too pretty for their own good, and they don't know what to do with it. I was never a pretty woman, but I do not think it is vanity to say that I am attractive enough, well turned out, with a good complexion. Mr. White has never complained. It's a shame I never met young Cleo. I'm sure I could have helped her find the right path.
So you met Lady Law, Maddie Schwartz.
I knew her when I was a child. Everyone in that neighborhood knew her. She was the one who comforted me when your future husband made me cry. Milton made lots of children cry. Did you know that? He was a miserable, fat boy, sitting in his family's corner grocery, studying his books. I was only 6 years old, a first grader, and this college boy decided to taunt me because he heard another child use my nickname, Cleo. My real name is Eunetta. Can you blame me for preferring Cleo? The nickname had been bestowed by other children, as nicknames usually are. I suppose some people anoint themselves, but that's a little sad, isn't it? We were studying the ancient Egyptians, and there was a drawing of Cleopatra in profile. A boy, thinking he was mocking me, said, "Miss Henderson, this looks like Cleo, her with her nose always up in the air." My nose was beautiful, straight, delicate, perfectly formed. It was like walking around with a 10-carat diamond. Only no one could take it from me. So people tried to make me feel bad about it. Tried to pretend that my beauty was ugliness. That up was down, black was white. But their teasing couldn't get me because they couldn't mask their envy. I had light eyes and a pretty mouth and slanting cheekbones, but really, it was my nose that organized everything, made me beautiful. I never had an awkward phase, conceited as that might sound. Maybe I should have. Men started coming around way too early, when I was 14, 15, and by the time I was 21, I was tired of fighting them off. That's how I ended up with two babies and no husbands. Soon I simply was Cleo. No one remembered Eunetta, and no one realized they had saved me from the one ugly thing about me. I didn't think about it twice until the day that Milton heard my cousin use my name in his parents' store.
"What you gonna get with your pennies, Cleo?"
Uncle Box had been to visit. He wasn't our uncle, and I don't know why he was called Box, and I don't know whatever happened to him. All we knew at the time was that he came and went. And when he came, it was like a party for no reason, the best kind of party. The children got money, while my father glowered in the corner. My father hated parties, fun, anything that suggested that we might enjoy our time on this earth. "Probably some now and laters," I said to Cousin Walker.
"Cleo?"
Milton asked as I pushed my money toward him.
"What kind of name is that?"
"It's short for Cleopatra," I said. "People say I look like her." He laughed,
like some dumb colored kid could ever look like Cleopatra. "That's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. She was royalty. You're just a poor jig."
Jig. That was most definitely the word he used, jig, short for jigaboo. The other children laughed at me, as if they were somehow not implicated by Milton's disdain. I was alone, mocked. I burst into tears and ran from the store, forgetting my candy and my money.
"Why are you crying, little girl? Are you lost? Is there trouble at home?"
I raised my face, holding my arm across the bridge of my nose, my beautiful straight nose, ashamed of my tears. I would pay for those tears with my schoolmates. They would want to see them again. They would try to see if they could break me as that horrible fat Milton Schwartz had. I looked up, 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 into the face of Lady Law. Everyone knew Ms. White. She was police, but she was okay. She didn't want to lock people up if she didn't have to, but Lord help you if you tried to walk down the street with a bottle in a brown bag when Ms. White was out and about.
I stammered out my story in a jumble of hot, humiliated words, but somehow she followed every detail.
There are people, scholars, who believe that Cleopatra was Nubian, she told me. Now, let's go back to that store and get your money back.
She escorted me into the grocery. I got my candy and my money, which astonished me. Was that justice? Was that the law? Did Milton owe me candy for free because he had tried to take something from me? When someone tried to hurt you, did they owe you more than you deserved? Who owes you, Maddie Schwartz? And who do you owe? At any rate, I promised myself at 6 that the one thing that nobody would take from me again was my dignity. But the promises we make to our young selves are hard to keep, as you have learned, Maddie Schwartz. For 20 years, however, I did keep my dignity. I cried over no man, not even the two who left me with 2 little boys and no wedding rings. I held my head high, even when I had to wear clothes from the church box. I was Cleopatra, a Nubian queen in hiding. And then I met a man, the king I always wanted, and that was the end of me. Now it was 5, almost 6 months later. The water in the lake was warming, shifting. Tiny creatures nibbled at what was left of my clothes. Rays of light pierced the murk at midday. But it couldn't reach me. Somehow that thing that had become me, that inconsiderate, restless rag of a body that had replaced my beautiful one, it moved, blocking or disconnecting a wire. A man heading to a rendezvous at the reptile house one night noticed the lights at the fountain had gone out. At least I've decided that's who it must have been, what he was up to. Someone with a secret life, his heart racing, his senses at full alert. Everybody in the neighborhood knew what kind of men hung around the reptile house at night. Like calls to like. A man with a hidden life could feel a secret at the heart of something ordinary, sense that the dead lights were part of something larger, something deader. He wrote a letter to Mr. Helpline, wondering why this bit of civic beauty had been allowed to go dark. He sent me to you. You sent a man to the fountain. Rowing across the lake that was like the river outside of hell, in the myths they taught us in school. May you all rot in hell. What was the verse they taught us in school? For want of a nail. Well, for want of a light bulb, I was about to be found. And yes, a kingdom of sorts would be lost. Lives would be ruined. A king would be toppled. Hearts would be broken. And all that's on you, Maddie Schwartz. I had the good sense, the dignity, to stay silent. Part 2. June 1966. When Maddie stepped off the elevator, cardboard box from the luncheonette in hand, she immediately registered what she could only describe as an absence in the newsroom, a place already familiar and dear to her. A layer of sound had been stripped away. The wire machine still clacked and caroled, and the phones rang, but the conversations were muted. No shouts, no laughter, only essential murmurs, the bare minimum of words required as the newspaper steamrolled toward its final edition, the 8-star. The features editor, a deep-bosomed, red-faced woman named Honor Livingston, was waiting in the helpline cubbyhole with the paper's top editor, Mr. Marshall. It was like finding God loitering by your mailbox. Maddie put down the cardboard box of sandwich and coffee with trembling hands. Something terrible had happened. That was the only explanation. Seth? Milton?
Madeline Schwartz,
Mr. Marshall began. Yes, she said, although he had not been asking a question. It was disturbing that he knew her name. Was she in trouble?
What could she have done? Had there been a mistake in her story about Mrs. White? How bad could it be? She was still on probation. She could be let go without cause. Maybe Cal had accused her of something awful because she had stood up for herself over the overtime issue.
There are two police detectives in my office waiting to speak to you.
Her knees buckled, and she bolstered herself, palms flat, to her desk. Seth, one part of her mind screamed, even as another part whispered, Ferdy. But no one knew about Ferdy. She was in trouble. Something terrible had happened.
We don't have much time, Mr. Marshall said, his voice low and swift. It was a lucky thing you were at lunch when they arrived.
Maddie registered the inaccuracy of this. She was fetching lunch, not taking it for herself. She brought her lunches from home most days.
The police are here because Mr. Heath tells us you called DPW about the lights at Druid Hill Park.
Yes, I do that sometimes. Handle smaller problems. Did I make a mistake?
A worker has found a body there. A Negro woman. They want to know why you called, what you can tell them about the person who inquired about the lights.
There was a letter. She tried to remember every detail she could. Handwritten, a masculine hand. Had there been a name? She thought so, but she also remembered that the name had struck her as false. Not John Smith, but similarly generic. She hadn't checked the name because the letter wasn't running in the paper, so there was no need to verify the sender. Once Mr. Heath had published a letter signed Seymour Butts, and now Maddie was required to go behind him.
And you got rid of it,
Mr. Marshall said. She started to say no, that she kept a file of the answers she handled on her own until the issues were resolved. But his deep-set brown eyes held hers, and she knew, as she so often knew,